Yeah, no, she's like the J. Edgar Hoover of the New York Times. This is the last person whose name you ever want to appear in your inbox.
Welcome to the Powers That Be Daily, Puck's podcast focused on the intersection of Wall Street, Washington, Silicon Valley, and Hollywood, and the players who run it all. I'm Peter Hamby. It's Monday, April 15th, which means it's Media Monday. Today, I'm talking to John Kelly about a rebellion inside the New York Times over their coverage of the war in Gaza and the investigation underway into Times employees who may have leaked confidential information about the paper's reporting. As John explains, the Times is once again furious at staffers who apparently have a hard time separating their personal views from the job of journalism. And leadership at the Times has tapped their in-house legal enforcer to dig into the leaks. John and I also talk about some big-name resignations from the board at Paramount as Sherry Redstone's negotiations with Skydance continue to irritate shareholders. We'll discuss all that and much, much more on today's episode of The Powers That Be. Are you tired of sleeping hotter than hell? I sure am. I sleep hot. There's something crucial about sleep that eludes us when we're too warm, too uncomfortable, and too caught in the web of our own thoughts to drift off. And while curiosity fuels our days, science tells us that cool sleep recharges our nights. That's where Chili Pad by Sleep Me comes in. Meet the bed cooling system that elevates the quality of human life through cool sleep. The Chili Pad bed cooling system is your new bedtime solution. I love it. It lets you customize your sleeping environment to your optimal temperature, ensuring you fall asleep, stay asleep, and wake up refreshed. Chili Pad works with your existing mattress. It's a water-based mattress topper that continuously controls your bed temperature from 55 to 115 degrees, allowing your body to rest and recover. This isn't just about escaping the heat, it's also about optimizing your sleep for better health, more energy, and improved physical and cognitive performance, which I obviously need hosting a podcast. Chili Pads are designed for one or two sleepers, so if your sleep partner likes to sleep at a different temperature, or you only need it for one side of the bed, that's okay too, and we know that's crucial. Plus, you can schedule automated temperature changes to trigger deep sleep. But when I'm at home, Chili Pad solves those problems. So trust me on this one. Visit sleep.me/powers to get your Chili Pad and save up to $315 with code POWERS. This offer is available exclusively for Powers That Be listeners and only for a limited time. Order it today with free shipping and try it out for 30 days. You can return it for free if you don't like it with their sleep trial. Visit www.sleep.me/powers because you're not just investing in better sleep, you're creating a better life. Happy Monday, everybody. Welcome to the Powers That Be. If it's Monday, it is, of course, Media Monday. It's also tax day. John Kelly, this is obviously a very basic insight about taxes. I didn't really realize until last year. The marriage benefit, it's real. It's very real. No wonder everyone talks about it.
it's very real, and we'll find ways to... We'll go through your 1040s, Peter, and find a bunch of other losses, too, that we can rack up here, and we'll let everyone know in a couple months what's coming back to you.
Cool. When Puck is acquired for $700 billion, we can talk about my capital gains burden. John, I want to talk to you today about a rebellion, it seems like, on the board at Paramount as Sherry Redstone negotiates with David Nightmare. Ellison and Skydance. I know, seriously. Talked to Bill a lot about that lately, but I'm interested in your insights. But I want to start today by talking about a really, I thought, interesting and well-done article in the Wall Street Journal about the New York Times that popped over the weekend. The headline is, New York Times bosses seek to quash rebellion in the newsroom. Look, every Times rival loves to dig into New York Times drama and twist the knife. There's a little bit of that going on here. They basically use the news peg of an investigation into several New York Times employees for possibly leaking information, confidential information related to their coverage of the Gaza war to The Intercept a few months ago. And Joe Kahn is involved. It's a big, big drama. I want to dig into it. But they also go back and talk about, you know, James Bennett and the Send in the Troops op-ed and some of the the Don McNeil scandal and some of the Black Lives Matter coverage and just the general idea that some of the younger employees at the New York Times and other news organizations and other and all organizations, frankly, are having a difficult time navigating the line between being quote unquote objective journalists and also advocating for their own personal political views. But the main nut of this story, the story begins thusly. The New York Times is investigating itself. Over the past several weeks, Charlotte Behrend, a top Times editor in charge of probing workplace issues in the newsroom, has summoned close to 20 employees for interviews to determine whether staffers leaked confidential information related to Gaza war coverage to another media outlet. It is the latest internal crisis at the Times, where management has been at odds with factions of the newsroom over union negotiations and coverage of sensitive topics like the transgender community and social justice. Now, the story in question at the Times was that really in-depth piece of reporting they did about how Israelis were victims of rape and sexual abuse at the hands of Hamas terrorists. Some staffers at the New York Times questioned the reporting behind that story and alleged that, quote, the suffering of Gazans isn't getting the same attention. Times stands by the story, but The Intercept, I noticed this a few months ago, basically wrote about how the Times was biased in their coverage in favor of Israel. And there seemed to be some internal stuff showing up in that Intercept article. And so executive editor Joe Kahn said in an interview with the Wall Street Journal, and by the way, I agree with this, the idea that someone dips into that process in the middle and finds something that they considered might be interesting or damaging to the story underway and then provides that to people outside, that felt to me and my colleagues like a breakdown in the sort of trust and collaboration that's necessary in the editorial process. I haven't seen that before. End quote. What did you make of this story, John? Is this just another sort of whack at the New York Times from, another news organization that loves to see them in turmoil? Or, was there something deeper afoot here? Or is this just in keeping with something you talk about a lot on this podcast, which is the rage of the creative underclass, mm-hmm. The sort of younger employee bases at a lot of companies, a lot of newsrooms who, again, have a hard time separating their personal beliefs from not just the ideas of journalism in the ivory tower sense, yep. but also loyalty to a company and a business.
Well, let's zoom out first. This is fascinating on a number of levels. The New York Times has about 6,000 employees and makes about $2.5 billion a year in revenue, maybe a couple of hundred million of that in profit. By comparison, Snapchat, where you work as well, has about the same number of employees and, makes $5.5 billion in advertising revenue, So the Times is a publicly traded, but family-controlled business that operates much more like an academic institution, in my opinion, than it does a for-profit company, right?
And you used to work there. You used to work there. You
and,
get
and,
that.
And I was there, and I saw it with my own two eyes. So I remember when you come new to the Times, your new class has a lunch with, or in those days, with Arthur, AG's dad. I went to high school with him. It's hard to call him AG. He was Arthur up until the magic wand waved.
Call him Artie, anyway, just as a neg.
He's actually a lovely guy. He really is. But anyway, you sit down with Arthur in the Eagle Room on the 15th floor of the Times building, and the first thing he'd say is, "This is a business." And you kind of think, well, not really, because of these factors that I just mentioned. Although at the time, the Times company had all these assets, 20% of the Red Sox, part of the Hancock Tower, About.com, divested from all of them and became really just the New York Times media company with Wordle and Cooking and all these things that you and Dylan talk about all the time. And it's a mission-driven public company. So does it suffer the vulnerabilities of an academic institution all the time for the very same reason? People who work at the Times, maybe because of the union, but also just because of the mission and the sharpness of their elbows, they view it as lifetime appointment. So they don't give a shit about things like bad-mouthing their colleagues and creating all kinds of trouble. And in many cases, don't at me. These are not on the creative side. These are not 9-to-6 jobs, 5 days a week, 52 weeks a year where people are checking badges, right? Like, mm-hmm. people listening to the show are very smart and sophisticated media consumers. Think of your favorite New York Times reporter, Google them, see the number of bylines they've written in the last 6 months compared to somebody here at Puck, right? We're asking for very different things. There's a lot of time to complain, Peter, and cause trouble. There was an authentic schism at the Times, which is a essential part of, you know, democracy and the discourse and all that, yada yada. We all know that, right? But there's an essential schism between generations, between a generation that sort of suffered through the sharp elbows and the crying rooms there, and one that also doesn't want to take it anymore. And they have some valid points too. And what makes this case so tantalizing, yeah, it looks like there was a flaw in the Gettleman story, and it was written with a couple of freelancers, one of whom had political views that was expressed publicly. And Gettleman was not liked by a lot of people, so he's got his time in the barrel. And guess what journalists do? They leak things, right, mm-hmm. all the time. And the Times is the traditional beneficiary of that instinct, and it doesn't like it when it's done within its own ranks, which is really what's going on here. And what Joe is saying is valid as an executive. He's not wrong about it. But the other side of that is that, of course, expressing an opinion to an external news organization is a totally accepted belief in the culture upon which within which they work. So it's complicated. I will tell you this, though, as someone who did work there, when you're dealing with Charlotte Berendt, you're fucked. Those 20 people are in big trouble. They call her an editor in the story. She is not. She is I think she's a trained lawyer, HR executive. And when you're meeting with her, you are on the do not fly list big time. So I think that this is a very serious development in the careers of those people. I will also say that, like, and I think we're mano a mano on this point. There are so many ways to express discontent within an organization that it seems like we're just negligently bypassed here. If there were concerns about this, have a meeting. Talk to your manager. I'm being serious here. I know it sounds like I'm being cute, but don't just shame people. And the way that this came out was rough and icky. And the other part that makes it worse was the way the Times capitulated. And if you recall, the Intercept story, I think it was based on a podcast appearance on The Daily that one of the reporters was involved in, and they didn't publish the show, maybe for good reason, but I think also because there was probably some ass covering that went on there as well. So it's one of these terrible situations where no one looks good. It reveals that there's a culture that has a lot of priorities. You know, making money is one of them, and this is not an issue that's going to prevent the New York Times from making any money. It's going to have zero impact on the P&L. It will become a chew toy, I think, for angry people inside the business. And one of the funny things here, and I guess I will rest my case on this point, Peter, which is people don't like as much as the Times is a very unhappy place to work for a lot of people. But what makes it unhappy is that people don't leave. And this is a sign that there is significant angst inside, and it's going to be hard to drain it.
You could go work at The Intercept if you're angry. I don't know, just a thought. I should give a shout out to Charlotte Klein at Vanity Fair, who I think broke news of when this investigation began back in February. The Wall Street Journal did some reporting to follow up on it, I should mention. A couple things jumped out at me. Joe Kahn, in this interview with the Wall Street Journal, implies that some of the restive behavior from the staff there is coming from, quote, digital savvy workers who are skilled in areas like data analytics, design, and product engineering, but who weren't trained in independent journalism. He also suggested that colleges aren't preparing new hires to be tolerant of dissenting views. So Joe Kahn sort of channeling John Haidt there. But the idea that perhaps some of these leaks aren't actually coming from the newsroom itself, they're coming from the kind of product data engineering people who live presumably in New York City and have political views that aren't really aligned with the conduct of journalism. That makes sense to me as a possible mm-hmm. source of these leaks. Also, speaking of Berendt, and I didn't know she was such an enforcer in the way that you described, but she is a lawyer by training whose official title is Director of Policy and Internal Investigations. Okay, now that I'm reading that, she does sound
She's like the J. Edgar Hoover of the New York Times. This is the last person whose name you ever want to appear in your inbox.
So, again, according to the journal piece, she asked for the names of participants in a group chat for Middle Eastern and North African Times employees and asked some staffers to name others who had discussed concerns about the Gettleman story. That's the story about October 7th, we should say. People familiar with the interview sessions said at least one session lasted longer than an hour. One staffer complained about the Gettleman piece in a letter to the Standards Department, an official channel, for raising internal concerns about the Times journalism. That channel must be a horror show, by the way.
Yeah,
Barron, really? Who has obtained the letter from another source, later called the author in for questioning. In the interview, she asked if anyone else helped her write the letter and for her communications with a worker on the Daily podcast. So the link from the Daily staffer to the Intercept seems like it's pretty clear according to this reporting, and Barron is really drilling down on this stuff. But again, there's also another vignette in this Wall Street Journal piece that there was a Zoom call where sometimes employees showed up and had Palestinian flags as the backdrop of their Zoom background. And so again, there's nothing profound to say here other than this just falls under the ongoing category of newsrooms dealing with, employees who have a hard time separating their personal political beliefs, their identities, and what's right and what's wrong from the actual conduct of journalism, which can offend your sensibilities. And every news organization pisses people off and always has.
And every company in the world, too. This is something that every company is going through. And we recognize that it's also a generational thing, too. I think that you and I are of the age where you were told to get in line, and it wouldn't have occurred to us to express our views at work that way. It just wasn't, this is different. And I get that a new generation just thinks that that's utterly ridiculous. But if you ladder this up, I don't want to overstate this, there is a real brand threat that has not emerged here. But I think this is probably one of the few things that does keep AG up at night. If you go to, Peter, you actually grew up in the South. If you went to a number of homes and put the New York Times in the paper, they would say, I would never, ever, ever read this. I just don't trust it at all. And why do they not trust it? For reasons that I think cosmopolitan people laugh at. They think, they think it's as ridiculous as we think Fox News is ridiculous. When you hear about incidents like this, that's what they're talking about, though. That is what they're talking about. That there are deeply held political beliefs of people who work there that are internally expressed, and it's complicated and unbelievably hard to manage through. I actually sympathize with every single person, Charlotte, Joe, the people involved who are engaged in this, because this is messy in every conceivable way.
Speaking of messy, I want to take a quick break and come back and talk about the drama at Paramount. Hey, Powers That Be listeners, I'm here to tell you that there's no reason to panic the next time you're searching for the perfect gift. Now you can use Gift Mode on Etsy. Gift Mode on Etsy takes the stress out of gifting so you can find the perfect item for anyone and any occasion. It's easy. Just tap or click Gift Mode on your Etsy app or Etsy.com. Then answer a few short questions about who you're shopping for and what they like. And Gift Mode instantly gives you a curated list of gift ideas based on hundreds of personas. I use Etsy all the time and have for years. I bought my brother some artwork. I bought my wife some jewelry. I even bought a rug for our living room on Etsy. I love it. But there's a lot of pressure around gifting. I usually have a hard time thinking of gift ideas for friends and family members around the holidays or birthdays in my life. And sometimes I get super stressed trying to find the perfect thing. But now with Gift Mode on Etsy, I can search hundreds of gifting personas and find so many incredible items. And I actually just found the perfect gift for a buddy who's just as into Cincinnati sports as I am, a hot cup of Joe Burrow mug. That's right, I found that on Etsy. It's amazing. Now it's simple to find gifts made by independent sellers for all the people in your life. So whether you need a housewarming gift for the new homeowner or a birthday present for the pickleballer, Gift Mode has you covered. Need to find the perfect gift? Don't panic. Try Gift Mode on Etsy now.
Do you wake up in a cold sweat from your work dreams?
Have a coworker who keeps inviting you to do escape rooms?
Can't get a coworker to agree to do escape rooms?
Or are you just genuinely not sure how to take the next step in your career?
I'm Kate.
And I'm Kim. And together we run Amy Poehler's company, Paper Kite Productions.
We've been friends and colleagues for years, so we know how important it is to feel like someone has your back at work.
And we want to be that for you.
So we're hosting a weekly advice show where we answer all your work-related questions.
Something amazing happened. I got offered my dream job.
How am I supposed to bring this up to him without hurting his feelings? What should I do?
I want to like skip the pleasantries without being an asshole.
Careful, money and friends, they don't mix, babes.
They don't. And don't work with your friends, make your friends at work.
All right, I can't believe I'm going to say this, but that was actually $1 million advice.
Whether you need advice or just love to listen to other people's problems, this show is for you.
Listen and follow Million Dollar Advice, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odyssey podcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odyssey podcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/odyssey podcast.
Welcome back to the Powers That Be, everybody. It's Media Monday. I'm talking media with John Kelly, my fearless leader at Puck. John, you sent me a link right before you hopped on the podcast from The Hollywood Reporter. Paramount confirms that board members will step down at annual meeting amid Skydance deal talks. These four board members, Don Ostroff, Nicole Seligman, Frederick Terrell, and Rob Clear, will all depart Paramount's board in the next few months. This obviously comes after Sherry Redstone entered into exclusive talks with Skydance, that's owned by David Ellison, about a sale that would basically mean Ellison would acquire National Amusements, which is the Redstone family's holding company, and then merge it with Paramount. One reason this is so controversial is that the private equity giant Apollo is over here offering them more money, an all-cash bid, for just a clean buy of everything.
Yep.
And so it just, you know, I've talked to Bill Cohan about this a couple times on recent podcasts. These board resignations, this is a new development, basically making clear and bringing into public view the unsettling nature of these negotiations for Paramount shareholders. Yeah. Can you explain for the audience, though, like why these board members would be pissed about this whole deal?
Yeah, sure. And I can tell you, I didn't go to law school, but I know that when four Sherry Redstone loyalists, two of whom, Nicole Seligman and Rob Clear, are lawyers, the other of whom, Frederick Terrell, is the head of investment banking at Wells Fargo, and Don Ostroff, my buddy, full disclosure, but a very smart career person, when they leave, it means that they are presumably terrified of the legal, although they have D&O insurance, but like sort of, you know, reputational damage coming in the form of shareholder lawsuits. And they probably just don't agree with the deal. You pointed out, we do not know a lot about the Ellison deal other than that it is for National Amusements, which is the Redstone mm-hmm. holding company. The Apollo deal, which is $26 billion.
John, can I interrupt? I keep saying National Amusements on this podcast. I have read about it. Can you just explain to me like what that is versus what Paramount is?
No problem. The Redstones, Sumner Redstone, the pater familias of this, who built this, these two once great companies, which were merged and then split, and then is, you know, because they were in different businesses, and then Sherry merged again in order to sell them. He started his career. He was a lawyer in Boston, Copley Square guy, and he bought movie theaters called National Amusements. The family owns them in largely secondary international markets. There are a lot in Russia. There are a lot in Latin America. So it's the movie theaters. The company is literally the movie theaters, preferred equity investment from Byron Trott, which they, you know, which is going to come to. And he's the banker. So he's eating out of both sides here. Smart guy. And various loans and obligations. And crucially, 10% economic ownership and 77% voting control of the entity of Paramount Global. It used to be of Viacom and CBS Corp, and now it's Paramount Global. So if somebody buys Paramount, the Redstone family gets $2.6 billion of that, based on the Apollo offer, and still has the National Amusements headache to deal with on its own. The prefs, the huge loan to Wells Fargo, where Frederick Terrell works, and... but if they buy National Amusements, Sherry's done. And the, you know, it's clean for her and her family. She's out. She's out of the whole thing. So the challenge is that, you know, this is not investment advice. The deal for National Amusements is cleaner for the Redstones. It is not cleaner for the investors. And these Paramount investors are furious. The letters have started to fire. Don't forget, like, the biggest investor in Paramount, the person who owns the most of the company, is still Warren Buffett. And this other great investor named Mario Gabelli, who's been, I think he was in Viacom in 1987, and he's still been holding on. So the resignation of these four board members, to me, is a significant sign that they're, you know, Sherry runs the boardroom. She can do whatever she wants. She can you know, move the whole thing to Siberia or the, you know, the bottom of the Indian Ocean, but they don't agree with her, is what it seems, clearly, and they're resigning to hopefully preserve their good name in this. Matt pointed out a great detail on Thursday night in what I'm hearing, which was that Charles Phillips, who was on the Viacom board and is now on the Paramount Global board, is an old Ellison buddy, which has sort of been underappreciated here. Centerview, which is one of the firms advising the Redstones, is certainly worked on. They work on a million things, and Blair Arfon is a sort of brilliant guy. But they've worked on plenty of Oracle deals before. And here's a theory, though, Peter. I think everyone thinks this thing is done, cooked, delivered for Ellison, that, like, you know, the dudes at Redbird are getting ready to get into operating roles, et cetera, et cetera. I do not think that. I don't think the Apollo bid is perfect, but I actually, I'm not going chalk on this one. I think that this thing has a long way before it gets settled, and that Apollo walks away with at least some of these assets. I think that the shareholder headaches are going to be so significant that if all David Ellison wants is truly, truly, truly wants is Paramount, that this thing is about to get interesting. It is, but it is, to my mind, the craziest M&A circus that we've seen in this industry in ages, and the craziest that we've seen, you know, in, like, oh God, I mean, I can't think of one. These companies were worth tens of billions of dollars separately decades ago, and it's worth $9 billion now? It's insane.
It sure does just sound like a nightmare. And yeah, you're right. I mean, like, one reason we'd named this podcast The Powers That Be, about that great David Halberstam book about, you know, the media titans of old, you know, Bill Paley and everyone else.
Yep.
they're not being sold for scraps, but it's certainly not, you know, at the place they once were. John, have a great week, buddy.
All right, man. I'll see you in the Slack.
Thanks so much for listening to another episode of The Powers That Be. As a reminder, The Powers That Be is the official podcast of Puck. We'd like to thank Ben Landy, Liz Goff, and Alex Bigler for their editorial and production guidance. If you like what you hear, please share with a friend. It really helps us keep delivering the inside scoop that only Puck can offer. Follow us on Twitter at Puck News. I'm Ben Landy. See you tomorrow. This has been a presentation of Odyssey. Please listen, rate, review, and follow all episodes wherever you get your podcasts. The Powers That Be Daily is executive produced by John Kelly, co-founder of Puck, Bob Tabador, and Ben Landy, executive editor at Puck.